It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have some great conversations lined up for you. We'll check in with the Pandemic Action Network for an update on the spread of the coronavirus across the country and the steps being taken to both mitigate the outbreaks and get Americans vaccinated. Then we'll talk to the news editor of Science about the impact of the pandemic on pets. But first, to get things started, I'm joined by David Waddell, CEO and Chief Investment Strategist at Waddell & Associates, to discuss the stock market volatility that's been dominating the news recently. David, thanks so much for the time. I want to step through this and simplify everything as much as possible. So for those who aren't investors and don't trade stocks, or just for the more casual observer of the market, can you give us a big picture overview of how things generally work?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. The stock market is basically a market like every other market. You know, it's a place where buyers and sellers come together and they haggle over price. And sometimes they disagree, and they disagree to a great extent, which is behind some of the volatility we're seeing in these interesting stocks like GameStop and Blockbuster and AMC, and even Tootsie Roll Industries is caught up in this as well. But in general terms, it's a $50 trillion marketplace of buyers and sellers with corporate stock in play, and the price is determined through the negotiating process.
All right, now let's dive into some of the players involved in the market issues that everyone's been hearing about and some of the terminology associated with all of it. Hedge funds, what are they?
So a hedge fund is just an investment partnership, and the investors in hedge funds have to be qualified, meaning they have to either make a bunch of money or have a bunch of money to have access. And the idea is they're lightly regulated, and they don't need to be because the investors are rich and can afford the losses. So hedge funds really operate in a less regulated arena of the marketplace. And they're given great authorities by their investors. Just go out and figure out how to make money, right? And they can do it by, well, now we're going to talk about this, selling shares short or buying long or funding individual private companies. Basically, whatever it takes to generate a positive rate of return for their qualified investors, which are typically institutions or rich people.
Next thing I want to get to, and it's something you mentioned a moment ago, shorting a stock. How does that work?
You know, if you think a stock's going to go up, you buy it. If you think a stock's going to go down, you can actually borrow it from somebody, then sell it, and then buy it back at a lower price. So you're selling high and buying low. That is a short trade, but you do have to go borrow the stock. Now, the bad thing about selling a stock short, meaning betting it'll go down, is that if it goes up, it can go up infinitely, right? So if you're betting on a stock going up, and you buy a stock for $100 and it goes to zero, you're out $100. If you're betting a stock will go down and it goes up infinitely, you're out infinite dollars. And that creates sort of an asymmetric situation for short sellers. And if they get squeezed, which is that is where you're going next, those stock prices can just roll to the moon and create a lot of damage for those individuals.
So the reason for shorting a stock would mainly be because you think that stock isn't going to do well. And there could be a number of reasons for that, like bad management or economic changes, all kinds of different things.
Well, I mean, the reason why GameStop was such a popular short, and there are actually more shares shorted than on the marketplace, which is technical, is because, you know, they live in strip malls. It's a retailer that's been losing money. They've been shuttering stores. And so it was a natural place for people seeing sort of the Blockbuster effect to go and bet on the company's demise. There was a large hedge fund that went in there and did that. Melvin Capital bet a lot of money on its demise. It had been making a lot of money. It's CEO recently purchased a place in Miami for $44 billion. He's 42 years old. It's been, you know, really a gift that kept on giving until, you know, there was this Reddit chat room and people mobbed together in a flash and ended up buying the shares, which worked against the short. So, yeah, the shorts are going to congregate in names like AMC, which is obviously under duress due to COVID, and GameStop, which is under duress because the business model has changed to online. And, of course, they had been selling consoles and video games in their stores. So, yes, you're targeting firms that you think are marked for death.
I'm joined by David Waddell, CEO and Chief Investment Strategist at Waddell & Associates. We're talking about the stock market volatility that's been dominating the news over the past couple of days. A short squeeze, basically what the Reddit users have been doing with the GameStop stock. What does that mean?
Well, what's interesting about this is, like I said, there was actually more, there were more shares shorted than were available. If the stock moves against you, you want to cover your short because you're exposed to infinite losses. There was some good news about GameStop. Sony and Microsoft came out and said, you know, we might put some future games on discs. There was agreement with Microsoft that was relatively positive. During COVID, some of their online and retail sales actually went up a little bit. And then there was a notable investor who took a board seat in the company. And so the shares started to rise a little bit from, call it, 3 to 20. Well, 3 to 20 is a pretty big move, and I don't know whether all of that was fundamentally merited or not, but since there were so many people short, they were left in positions of losses. They had to go buy the shares so that they could close out their shorts. And then this chat room thing started where a community of 3 million people said, hey, let's go buy all the shares we possibly can or put options out there. Because if we do, then it means that the shorts will have to purchase them from us at ever higher prices. And so there was an enormous amount of buying demand. There was no supply on offer because the shorts were trying to close out by buying them too. And that's what led to the squeeze, which means the stock just goes higher. So basically, high demand, no supply equals higher prices. That's a short squeeze.
Companies like Robinhood or TD Ameritrade restricting the trading of certain stocks like GameStop. Why'd they do that, and why the pushback from so many to that move?
Well, there are two reasons to do it. One, to protect their investors, and that's possible. Another reason to do it is because the market is so volatile that they themselves are having technical issues dealing with trading. So it can either be to protect themselves or to protect the users, but it certainly, you know, brings to light, well, is Wall Street fighting back against the retail investors, and it'll light up the chat rooms. But I don't know if it's technical or if, again, it's trying to, you know, keep people from hurting themselves.
And finally, your average investor with a 401k, are they being impacted by all of this?
Not really. Remember, the market itself is $50 trillion, and the losses, and I don't know if this number is right or not, but I read it somewhere, in GameStop accounts for about $25 billion. So it's a tiny proportion of the market overall. And the stocks that are being targeted for these short squeezes, there are about 300 of them, make up less than 2% of the market overall. So this is really an interesting marketplace anomaly, but is not going to impact the broader market in general. And I still think with the market, or I should say the economy growing and the government in full support, you know, things are positive for the market overall. So this is very interesting, and it's a further democratization and another example of the power of the social media flash mob. But I do not think it derails the market overall. Long-term investors should stay invested.
David Waddell, CEO and Chief Investment Strategist at Waddell & Associates, discussing the stock market volatility that's been dominating the news recently. David, thank you so much for the time and insight. We really appreciate it.
Man, I enjoyed it too. Thanks for inviting me.
All right, next up, I'm joined by Carolyn Reynolds, co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network, to discuss the latest developments with COVID-19 all across the country. Carolyn, thanks for checking in once again. Before we get to the current state of the pandemic, give us a quick rundown of the work the Pandemic Action Network does.
Thanks, Ryan. It's great to be with you. You know, we set up the Pandemic Action Network in April of last year as the pandemic was starting to rage around the world and in the United States. Because we feel that this is an issue that of pandemic preparedness that has been long, long neglected. And so we have stood up a coalition of now more than 90 partners and organizations we're working with in the United States and around the world who are all committed to working together to do everything we can to help both end this pandemic, but also help prepare and make sure the world is better prepared for the next one.
So at the state of the outbreak right now, about a month removed from the holidays, what do things look like across the country?
Well, I wish I had better news, but as you say, we're a month out from the holidays, and actually we're just about 1 year since the first case came to the United States and the World Health Organization declared this a public health international emergency. And we're in the most deadly phase of the pandemic now that we've seen since it began, with new variants spreading. We have a sad, grim milestone we've reached of over 435,000 lives lost in the U.S., 25 million confirmed cases and counting, and globally 100 million cases and more than 2.1 million lives lost. So even with vaccines rolling out, which is obviously a really promising development, now is the time that we have to be more vigilant than ever and do the things that we know are most effective in helping prevent the spread of the virus, which includes wearing masks, washing our hands, and keeping our distance, and also limiting essential travel, which over the holidays helped fuel some of this surge.
How much could these variants of the virus potentially complicate things?
Well, look, we are learning new information every day and about the spread of the variants. The good news is so far it seems that the science is telling us that the vaccines that have been approved for distribution in the United States, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, do appear to be effective. But again, we're learning new things every day. So as variants are spreading, this is actually, we're in a race against time to make sure that more people get vaccinated more quickly and that the science can keep up with the variants.
I'm joined by Carolyn Reynolds, co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network. We're talking about the latest developments with COVID-19 across the country. The Biden administration, tell us about some of the pandemic-related actions that have been taken over the past week and a half and what they mean for our COVID-19 response.
Yeah, well, so far we're very pleased that President Biden and his administration has really made this job one and has taken action and leadership right out the gate to address the ongoing pandemic, both at home and abroad. Some highlights of the Biden COVID-19 plan include, as many of you have heard, rolling out at least $100 million vaccinations in 100 days, and I think planning to accelerate that, ramping up supplies, including invoking something called the Defense Production Act to get more vaccines and more syringes and things that we need to deliver the vaccines delivered as quickly as possible, setting up that mass vaccination sites, hiring more healthcare workers, expanding access to testing, and many other things, including, of course, addressing the economic and social impacts of this crisis, getting more support to struggling families and small businesses, and getting schools opened as quickly as possible. Essentially, just a stronger federal response that we've been lacking for some time, and getting more support to the states and localities.
You mentioned schools. There was a new CDC report that was issued recently that really laid out in detail how little spread of the virus we've seen resulting from in-person learning. What stood out to you about their findings?
Yeah, well, I was glad to hear the new CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, say yesterday, schools should be the first to open and the last to close. I do believe reopening our schools safely has to be a top priority, and that is a major aspect of the Biden plan and what he's asking for support from Congress. We've seen the educational disparities that have been exacerbated due to the closure of schools and the move to remote learning. I'm a mom. My kids have been home since this thing started, since we went into lockdown last March, and are still remote learning. But we know that students from low-income households or those living with disabilities and especially minority groups have really suffered the most from remote learning. So we're glad to see this be a strong piece of the Biden-Harris administration, but we need Congress also to take action and give states and localities the resources they need to reopen schools quickly and safely as possible. And that means first and foremost, also prioritizing teachers for vaccinations.
I'm joined by Carolyn Reynolds, co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network. You can find out more at pandemicactionnetwork.org. When it comes to what Americans should continue to do to protect themselves, especially as these new, more contagious variants make their way through communities and as we wait to get vaccinated, what's your advice?
Yeah, well, of course, we are all hopeful about the impact of the vaccine. And
in Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We are proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
People should be going to their state and local public health department to find out how they get registered and in the queue for a vaccine. Rightly, priority is being given first to healthcare workers and to the elderly. I just had to navigate the system to get my own parents to get their first shot in the state of Virginia. It's a complicated process, but to go, hopefully that will get easier and better, the registration process. So sign up for a vaccine, but it's very important that you, even as you're waiting for that vaccine, and even after you do get vaccinated, to be vigilant, because we don't know the long-term effectiveness of the vaccines yet. We're going to only learn that over time. Will they be effective for 6 months, a year, longer? We just don't know yet. So it will be ever more important to continue wearing masks. And what we're finding out now is actually the importance of urging people to upgrade their masks, not just to wear their masks, but to wear masks with multiple layers. A tightly woven cloth mask and a blue surgical mask alone gives you about 60-80% of protection. But when you double that, it increases to about 90% protection. And if you're wearing one and the person you're with is wearing one, then it's going to be very, and you're practicing your distance, then it's going to be very difficult for that virus to spread.
And finally, last question, at the Pandemic Action Network, you're obviously very focused on this pandemic, but I'm sure you're also looking at what we've learned and can do better in the event of another one. What are some steps we should start taking now to get ahead of future pandemics?
Yeah, thanks, Ryan, for asking. I mean, first of all, an important part in ending this pandemic is not just getting Americans vaccinated and controlling the spread at home, but we've got to control it around the world. So we've got to ensure that people around the world get access to vaccines. And unfortunately, now we're seeing a very inequitable access. So the Biden administration is doing it. Part of its plan is to support the global COVID response. And we need to make sure that we tackle the pandemic everywhere. But we can all, as I say, practice the public health behaviors, get vaccinated when it's your turn. We need to go to trusted news sources, starting with the Centers for Disease Control website and your local state and health department websites to make sure you're getting accurate information. And you need to also talk to your local, state, and national representatives to make sure they're learning now and taking actions now to learn from this crisis and invest in better preparedness. And that means making sure that our frontline health systems, our local, state, and health departments have the resources they need to be able to stop outbreaks when they happen.
Carolyn Reynolds, co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network. You can find out more at pandemicactionnetwork.org. Carolyn, always great to catch up with you. Thanks so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ryan.
Finally, I'm joined by David Grimm, online news editor of Science and author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. He's here to discuss the impact of the pandemic on pets. David, thanks so much for coming on the show. Obviously, it hasn't just been us humans whose lives have been disrupted due to the coronavirus. The worlds of so many pets have been turned upside down, too. Focusing for a moment specifically on the ability of animals to contract or spread the virus, what have we learned over the past year?
Well, we've learned that pets, if they are getting it, which they probably are, there's been a couple studies that have shown that cats and dogs do seem to get the virus most likely through contact with people, that when they do get infected, their symptoms tend to be very mild. There's not really any evidence right now that pets are what we call a reservoir of disease, meaning that they are a source of infection for either other animals or for other people. And so the party line for public health officials and government health officials has basically been that pets don't really seem to be an important piece of the pandemic puzzle. In other words, that they don't seem to be getting very sick, and they don't seem to be an important way of transmitting the virus to humans.
I remember early on the stories about tigers in zoos contracting the virus. So it's not just pets that are susceptible. It's a wide range of wildlife, right?
Right. There have been tigers in zoos. I believe there have been other big cats in zoos. There have been cases. The most disturbing has really been mink. There's been, you know, lots of mink farms all over the world where mink have been coming in, infected, and people who run those farms have had to call, you know, large numbers of these animals. So we know animals can get infected with through this virus. But aside from mink, we haven't really seen big outbreaks in non-human animal populations.
All right. So as we make strides towards putting this pandemic behind us by getting vaccinated, what's the concern about pets and the virus moving forward?
Well, you know, the concern is whether pets would act as some sort of reservoir for the disease. And so the idea would be that even if people were getting vaccinated and their pets weren't getting vaccinated, and, you know, these pets were encountering other people that weren't vaccinated, you know, could pets be sort of harboring the virus, spreading it to people? There was also the concern that, you know, if your dog or cat are going outside and they're interacting with wildlife, say your dog's chasing a squirrel or your cat's, you know, hunting mice or whatever, might they be transmitting the virus to wildlife, and then might they be creating sort of a wildlife reservoir of the disease? And what you really don't want is you don't want these reservoirs out there, because even if you control the spread in humans, if you've got a lot of animals out there that are harboring the virus and able to transmit it, that's really going to prevent you from combating the virus in an effective way. So that was a concern. But again, we're not really seeing, at least with cats and dogs, that they seem to be significant transmitters of this disease either to humans or to other animals. So at least on the pet side, this reservoir concern hasn't really come to fruition. I guess the really open question at this point is, might there be issues with other types of animals or with wildlife in terms of being a reservoir for the disease?
I'm joined by David Grimm, online news editor of Science and author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. Let's focus on what you just mentioned for a moment, endangered animals, animals that could get wiped out in big numbers because of COVID-19. Aside from mink, what are some other animals we should be worried about?
Right, so there's black-footed ferrets, which are an endangered animal in the U.S., and your lab studies have shown that lab ferrets are highly susceptible to disease. So I think there have been efforts underway to vaccinate black-footed ferrets. There's also concern about animals, which we're not really sure quite yet how sort of susceptible they are or how dangerous the virus is in them. Great apes, which are obviously highly related to us, and so it would be expected to be as susceptible and maybe develop similar symptoms. You know, and with that, we're thinking not only about animals in zoos, you know, chimpanzees, gorillas in zoos, but also out there in the wild. If you've got, you know, for example, tourists in Africa that are infected with SARS-CoV-2, and then they have close contact with these animals, could they potentially spread the virus to these animals? And then you've got a very highly endangered or highly important population of animals out there that may be, you know, we certainly don't want to have an outbreak in a species, especially in a species that is endangered. So that's a big concern right now as well.
We've seen the process of creating a vaccine for humans play out. What would go into vaccinating certain animal species if that became necessary?
Right. So, you know, there are companies out there that are working on vaccines for animals, including pets. Russia has got a vaccine it's working on. There's a U.S. company called Zoetis that is also working on a vaccine. I think there may be a couple other U.S. companies that are also working on vaccines. But right now, while those companies sort of are allowed to study, at least in the U.S., they're allowed to study those vaccines and test them, they're not able to commercially market them, because the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA, has basically said that because pets, at least, are not an important part of this pandemic, that these companies don't have the USDA authorization to sell or distribute any vaccines that they make that would cover pets. Now, that could change if people start getting more concerned about pets. But for right now, there's not a lot of impetus for these companies to go a lot further, because there's no call right now to vaccinate at least cats and dogs. Now, again, a lot of these vaccines, the human vaccine, the idea is that that could be pretty readily adapted for animals. In fact, a lot of these vaccines were developed with animal testing. So we already know that they work in certain animals because they had to go through those trials before they could be used with people. So adapting this vaccine for other animals theoretically shouldn't be that difficult. Now, the dosing might be different, the amount might be different, things like that, but the fundamentals of the vaccine probably wouldn't change too much. So you wouldn't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel if all of a sudden tomorrow the government said, we got to vaccinate, you know, cats and dogs, or we got to vaccinate tigers at zoos. It probably wouldn't take a ton of work to create a vaccine for these animals. It would just be trying to figure out some of the minutiae of dosing and things like that.
One of the experts you spoke to in your piece on all of this for Science took a look ahead and talked about the potential for other pandemics down the road and how that risk seems to continue to grow. What were some of his concerns?
Well, right. So, you know, we still don't know exactly where this virus came from. I mean, I think the big suspicion that it was somehow transmitted from wildlife. And the problem is that, you know, as we kind of continue to invade the last wild places on Earth and continue to sort of have these animals in market and things like that, we're constantly sort of continuing our exposure to these animals that maybe we didn't have as much, at least hardcore exposure as we had in the past. And because of that, we're exposing ourselves to potentially all of these new viruses that we never had exposure to in the past. And so, you know, as scary as it sounds, you know, as an expert I talked to said, you know, we shouldn't just be thinking about SARS-CoV-2. We should be thinking about SARS-CoV-3, which is likely going to be around the corner. And really the only way we're going to be able to combat that is to A, rethink how we interact with our wild animals, but also B, developing vaccines right now, potentially for future viruses. You know, can we develop a vaccine that doesn't just work against this one coronavirus, but potentially all coronaviruses? You know, and that is where at least this one person, and I'm sure about, there are a lot of others in the public health community that agree, we have to be thinking long-term about how are we going to rapidly develop or even have vaccines on hand for the viruses that are likely to come at us in the future.
I'm joined by David Grimm, online news editor of Science and author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. Do we have a sense as to the types of animal species that are most likely carrying these kinds of viruses?
I don't think we have a great sense. I mean, bats, we know, have been a source of other viruses in the past. You know, people were talking about pangolins at some point during early in the pandemic. I think there's still a lot more that we don't know than we do know. And so, you know, one global strategy would be, you know, how can we sort of reduce our interaction with all wildlife, you know, because we don't know necessarily where this is going to come from. But again, you know, developing a vaccine that no matter what animal it came from would be some sort of universal, you know, whether it's a universal coronavirus vaccine or a vaccine against another type of virus so that, you know, if and when these interactions happen again, we're sort of better prepared than we were this time around.
Going back to the topic of pets for a moment, the change in lifestyle that so many Americans have undergone because of this pandemic, based on what you've learned, what kind of impact has that had on our pets, especially as we slowly but surely inch towards a return to normal?
Well, one of the big things, which was kind of heartening to see at the beginning of the pandemic, was that adoptions were going way up. And, you know, we still have, you know, millions of cats and dogs in shelters in the U.S., and a lot of them end up being euthanized every year. And so I think people were spending more time at home. They had more free time. People were getting pets. And so I think adoptions went up, way up, I think, early in the pandemic. The concern now is, you know, people losing their jobs, people returning to work, you know, that dog that you thought you were going to be able to spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with, now maybe you don't have as much time with that animal. Are you still going to be able to care for that animal as much as you were before? Or have you been forced to move somewhere? And this is, I believe the New York Times recently ran an article about this. Are you being forced to move somewhere that all of a sudden doesn't allow pets, and what's going to happen to all these animals that were adopted early in the pandemic? And so obviously we've got to think about people first, but, you know, pets are definitely part of this whole system that's going on there. You know, they're an important, very important part of our lives. And how do we sort of make sure that we're kind of planning appropriately for them as well in the coming months as things continue to change with the pandemic?
I'm joined by David Grimm, online news editor of Science and author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. And final question for you on that note, tell us a little bit about your book and what you found when you were putting that together.
Well, you know, so my book is really all about how we kind of forged this relationship with cats and dogs in the first place. You know, these used to be wild animals and now they're sleeping in our beds and we're spending, you know, thousands of dollars on them sometimes every year on vet care and organic food and things like that. And so, you know, I think what the pandemic shows, which other, you know, tragedies in the past, like Hurricane Katrina have shown as well, which is just how close we are to these animals, how much we care about them. You know, people, when we start talking about the pandemic early on, one of the big questions is, can my cat get this? Can my dog get this? What does that mean? They're not just concerned about their human family. They're concerned about their pet family as well.
David Grimm, online news editor of Science and author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. David, thanks so much for taking the time to run through all of that with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
All right, and that's going to do it for us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman. We'll be back same time, same place next weekend. Stay safe.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.